Hello, and welcome to Strange Dominions, a show where we investigate the unheard, the unseen, the unknown, and the unknowable. I am your host, Octavian Graves. I have a very special guest for tonight. I'm interviewing Timothy Renner. Timothy is the author of 7 books about the paranormal, 2 of which he co-authored with Joshua Cutchin. He is also a visual artist, musician in which he plays in the band Stone Breath, and the creator and host of the podcast Strange Familiars. We start our conversation talking about his interest in historical hermit accounts, and then traverse the strange of Bigfoot, magic, and the unexplained. If you have seen something strange or unusual, such as a cryptid, UFO, ghost, and anything in between, send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. And with that, let's get into the interview. And tonight, we are here with the one and only...
The Wizard!
Timothy Renner. How you doing, Tim?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's about time you came on this show.
Well, I've been avoiding it, so it finally caught me.
Yeah, I had to get you someday. So, you know, the show that you do, Strange Familiars, it wanders around a lot of different topics. I mean, it's obviously a paranormal show, but you guys go through a lot of different subsets of that and some, parallels to that. And so one of the most interesting parts of it is when you do your hermit episodes. And I know that you're kind of working on a new hermit book. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
So can you just tell us about where that started for you and like how you got into hermits and like, you know, where that came from?
Sure. Well, I was doing the historical Bigfoot books, which are collections of newspaper articles from, you know, the earliest I can find them. I don't think I've found any from the 1700s yet, but I found some from the early 1800s on up to 1920, I think 24, we have public domain now. We get new year of public domain every year now. So I think it's 24 that I'll be doing. I think the older book stopped at 1923. In any case, they're collections of these old newspaper articles and that I feel are about Bigfoot. And in those articles, from the earliest times until about the 1890s or so, they call Bigfoot wild men. So the name Bigfoot, I'm sure you know this, but you know, for the listeners, the name Bigfoot really didn't come into popular use until like the 1970s, really.
Wasn't it when Jerry Crew found that footprint that turned out to be a fake? That's kind of where the term came from.
Yeah, that started in the 50s. I think the late 50s that was, but it really didn't like start being used popularly until the like 1970s. You can find a few references to Bigfoot, you know, before that, but really where you could sell someone Bigfoot and they would know what you were talking about, that kind of happened in the 1970s. Before then, like I said, they were called wild men up until about 1890, 1900 in that time frame. For a while, they start getting called gorillas. And I think the reason for that is the discovery of the mountain gorilla. I shouldn't say discovery. The African people knew it was there. It became known to the people in the West, the mountain gorilla. And gorilla kind of became a popular thing. So it's like, you know, people had something to call these hairy things in the woods other than wild men. So they start calling them gorillas then. Not exclusively. You still get wild men overlap. That goes to the 20s or 30s, and then monster movies get popular, and you see this shift from them calling them gorillas to like hairy monsters or something like that, on up to the 50s and 60s, where you start getting Bigfoot and Sasquatch and so forth. But in any case, I'm collecting these old articles for these books, and the problem with the term wild man is it turns up more than just what might be Bigfoot creatures. Anybody that was like a mountain man that roamed into town was maybe had like long hair and, you know, kind of dressed rough or kind of any itinerant or anyone that was sort of outside the social norms of the time might be called a wild man or a wild woman. So as I'm turning up these articles of what again, what I feel is Bigfoot based on the behavior and the descriptions of the creatures in the article. I'm also turning up these other stories about these interesting characters. And some of them were hermits. So there's that. And around the same time I'm doing this, my wife, Allison, she's co-host of Strange Familiars with me. She is very into circus history, and especially, you know, late 1800s, well, mid to late 1800s and early 1900s circus history. And she said, you know, since you're into these wild men, you should start collecting circus wild men. I said, oh, that's a great idea. So I started collecting photos of circus wild men. And she bought me this one postcard. And she's like, well, this isn't a wild man, but he's kind of like a wild man. And it said, Billy Woodruff, hermit of, what's the town in Connecticut? I'm drawing a blank on the town. Anyway, had the town, Colebrook River. So Billy Woodruff, hermit of Colebrook River, Connecticut on it. Well, that's a neat photo. And I kind of tucked it in this pile of stuff by my desk. And I thought one day I'll look up and see, you know, what's the deal with that guy. And, you know, I think she probably gave me the photo at the beginning of the summer and then, you know, stayed in the pile of stuff. Eventually got shuffled to the top, probably about the end of summer. And I had a few minutes and I said, I'm going to look up and see what I can find on this guy. And I turn up this incredible story. It's on Strange Familiars. It's called William and the Fiery Flowers, that episode, if anyone's interested, of this hermit's life. Some of it is romanticized. Some of it is true, but he had this really incredible life story and wonderful kind of story about this kind of lost love that he had. And they described him as a New World Odin, as he kind of possibly tried to kill himself by lighting his hermitage on fire, his cabin on fire.
I wish I had that nickname.
Yeah, right. And his neighbor supposedly found him sitting in the middle of the flames, just holding this daguerreotype of the woman he loved that spurned him when he was much younger. Very, very interesting story. Bigfoot, you know, winds its way into that story as well. There was, you know, wild man sightings right in the area where he lived at the time he was living there that were, you know, by all descriptions, these big hairy Bigfoot creatures that people were shooting and weren't reacting to the shots and so forth. So there's a Bigfoot connection, but the whole story just completely fascinated me. And I said, well, I want to find if there's other pictures of this guy. And I found the photographer from the nearby town Winstead took, as far as I know, two photographs of him and one photograph of his house. And that's it. So I got those. And then I started collecting photos of other hermits because I was like, well, this guy's so interesting. And I started looking up other hermits and it just exploded from there. I started looking up their stories. And so many of these guys have really, really fascinating stories. I don't know. We've probably done 10 hermit episodes maybe now in Strange Familiars, and there's no end to them for sure.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, you know, how many do you have? Because I know I've listened to a couple. I can't remember how many, but yeah, so that sounds about right, like 10 or 12, something like that.
Yeah, maybe we haven't reached 10 yet, but we've done quite a few. We've definitely done quite a few. And some of them, I know we've done some episodes where we've done like two or three hermits in one episode. So depends how you count.
When you're researching them, is there certain phrases or like terminology that you use to find like hermits instead of just like vagabonds or, you know, like you said, like a woodsman rolling into town?
Yeah, you kind of have to read the articles about them. That's the thing, which I don't mind doing. I really love doing research. So if I turn up an article and I read it, and, you know, they'll call some of these guys hermits. We had a guy on that we did a story on the show who was not really a hermit. He was just kind of like a criminal from Gettysburg, Heist. It was a show called Last Man on the Gallows we did recently. And later articles described him as a hermit, but he wasn't really a hermit. He was just kind of a robber. You know, he just robbed people, but he, you know, he lived with other people. He had plenty of interchange with people, both criminal and otherwise. He was, you know, seen around town frequently, he held jobs and so forth. So, you know, I think they called him a hermit because he had this shack that, you know, this wood cutting shack for a while. So, it's, you know, was he a hermit? You know, kind of. And some of these guys are lesser hermits than others as far as their interactions with people. So I kind of make a judgment, you know, it's kind of left up to my own discretion. I guess it's like they say about pornography. You know, I know it when I see it. I know a hermit when I see it. So hermit is a good search term. Recluse is a good one. And then it's a matter of just kind of going down and reading the articles.
And so do you make a distinction between a bona fide hermit and just someone who wants to be left alone in the woods, or are they more or less the same thing?
They're more or less the same thing. But I think probably the original idea of a hermit, there was some kind of intentional and maybe spiritual angle to it, but certainly by, you know, the late 1800s, it was like any dude or woman who went off to live alone was, you know, hermit or hermitess accordingly.
Okay. So is there like a time frame where, I guess if you want to call it a movement, like the hermit movement kind of took off, or was it just certain individuals over, you know, a whole, like a long period of time? Because I know there's current, like, you know, there's hermits who live in modern times. I know that there was one in the news a couple months ago that had mm-hmm. his house burned down because I guess the property owner didn't agree to him being on there, even though the hermit said that it was a longstanding agreement or something like that.
Yeah, I remember the article. Yeah, I think it's harder to be a hermit nowadays than it was before. Property laws get more and more restrictive and so forth. Back in the 1800s and early 1900s, if you were living on like in a state forest or something as a hermit, they weren't going to run you out. But now I guarantee you they'd run you out right away. So property laws have gotten a lot more restrictive. It's definitely harder to be a hermit nowadays than before. So, I mean, there's always been hermits, I think. There probably always will be hermits, less now, like I said, than there were, you know, a century ago. But the sort of, you know, modern hermit movement, I guess you could make an argument that in the UK, starting in, I think in the late Renaissance, real early on, and this continued up through the 1800s, there were hired hermits. So if you were a lord and you owned property, it was very, very fashionable. If you had a cave on your land, or if you didn't, you would build a small kind of hermit hut or some kind of hermitage there. And you would essentially hire a hermit to live on your land. It was a very kind of noble thing to have a hermit on your property. And by hire them, usually they didn't get much more of a salary than they get, you know, meals and very, very small living expenses. They weren't getting rich. But, you know, it was a very common thing for these, you know, lords over there in the UK to have these hermits on their land. This is, by the way, where the garden gnome comes from. It was a representation of the hermit that, you know, but for people who couldn't afford it, I guess, you know, they had got a little hermit statue, which turns into the garden gnome over time. So that was a thing in the UK, and at least one of those professional hermits did end up coming over here. His name was John Smith. He was an actor and then a professional hermit in the UK. He came and lived in Irving, Massachusetts. He was called himself the Hermit of Irving Castle. He lived in a cave, very, very popular in the 1800s. People would go and visit him. He would hand out photographs of himself. I'm very lucky. I have two of those photographs, which are signed by him. He has a beautiful handwriting and a little note on the back about, you know, his cats or his pets that he had at the time. So he would sell those photographs to kind of tourists, just kind of, you know, make a little food money. And he sold an account of his life and so forth. So he was a professional hermit that turned amateur, I guess you could say. Although in the census, a lot of these guys under profession, it does say hermit, which is really, really interesting. Actually see that as their profession listed there in the census. Though, so kind of the golden age of hermitry, I think, is the late 1800s and early 1900s in the United States. There might be a lot of reasons for that. I think some of these guys at least were dealing with PTSD post-Civil War.
I was just going to say, I feel like the war probably caused a lot of people to just want to get away, as far away from humanity as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And they just, you know, kind of peaced out, like, I'm done. And they went off to live alone. Most of the stories in the paper, they love a good unrequited love story, or, you know, broken heart, or they say, you know, their wife died or their fiance died. Usually they were spurned in some way, and they go off, you know, according to the stories in the paper. And then they'll very briefly mention, like, oh yeah, he was also in the Civil War. And you go, okay, I think there might be a PTSD element here. And that continued. There's even some post-World War I hermits that, you know, I would say probably just, it was a form of just dealing with a PTSD. They just cut out of society and went to become hermits.
Yeah, I remember if you watched that Netflix show, I'm sure, I mean, everybody's watched it, Making a Murderer. I remember a very specific point when they're talking, you know, they couldn't interview him face to face. They had to do it through the phone in the prison. And he basically says, you know, when all this is done, I'm just going to get myself a piece of land and a nice little shack and find myself a woman, and I'm done. I'm out of here. That's just going to be my life. So it's such a, it's a very universal sentiment, especially in modern times. But I'm curious, because, you know, I remember the Hermit of Irving Castle episode. The way that you do your show is so, I don't know, like a very romantic kind of narrative. And I remember being at work, actually, and it was like a full moon, and I was just sitting in my car listening to that episode, watching the moon, and it was a very picturesque moment. But I'm curious, besides that, what have been some of your most favorite hermit stories? I mean, the one you just did about the guy getting blown up, McGuire was his name?
Yeah, J.J. McGuire.
Yeah, that was fascinating and really tragic, but just really interesting to listen to.
Yeah, that one, I mean, I truly believe we uncovered a real conspiracy there, that he was a blacksmith. They called him a hermit blacksmith in a small town. It was small at the time. This is 1920s California, Los Olivos. I was told I pronounced it wrong on the podcast, so I will correct that pronunciation here. And he ran afoul of some bigwigs in the town, you know, these kind of established families in the town, and they killed him. They blew him up with dynamite. The evidence was all there. It was very, very obvious. And these guys walked, they went free. And that was that. It was an incredibly interesting story and really, really tragic, but I do believe it's a real conspiracy that we uncovered with that one. You know, small town justice is maybe not a thing. I said on the show that it seemed like a plot from Deadwood. It really did. It seemed really, really kind of insidious and dark what this town did to this guy. But interesting, but not my favorite. I'd say my favorite is, and probably will always be, the first one, William Woodruff, which we call William of the Fiery Flowers. It's just such a romantic story. He took a vow of silence, and after, you know, supposedly getting heartbroken by this woman, and went off to live alone. And it's just this really, really beautiful story. And of course, Bigfoot's, you know, tied into it too. So I got to love it for that. But my second favorite for sure is the Wolf Hill Hermit from Gettysburg. And his name was Thomas, George Thomas, G-F-C-E Thomas, I think. He had a bunch of initials. But he, I read about him. And I thought, well, I looked on started looking on maps, and I thought, well, I can find where this guy was. I have a roundabout idea. I just need to get out and look. And they said he had his a cabin on a remote part of the battlefield, which was really interesting, because I've been all over Gettysburg. I'm like, there's no remote part of the battlefield, but yet there is. This is it's known as the part of the battlefield that's the hardest to get to. I'd never been there before. I found an old map, which I thought showed just a square where his cabin would have been. It wasn't labeled or anything, but it was the first map they made of the battlefield when they made it a national park in the 1890s. So he was living there at that time. And right in the area where the newspaper said his cabin was this little square. I said, well, that's got to be it. That has to be it. And John, who is comes out and does a lot of investigations with us, he's sometimes on the podcast as well. He very cleverly overlaid that old map onto, you know, Google Maps, lining up the creek and so forth. And we looked at it and I thought, well, that's either on parkland or it's right off of parkland. We should be able to find this if there's any evidence of where this cabin was. Meanwhile, I start digging into the story more, and it turns out I think this guy was practicing powwow based on some information I had in the articles. They talk about him having some problems with local neighbors, and he goes to the police, and the one article says they're trying to hypnotize me, which is odd. But then there's another article from a different paper that reverses it, and he says, if they don't leave me alone, I'm telling you, I'm going to cast a spell on them and hypnotize them. And I thought, oh, okay, that's a little bit different. And they said scraps of paper all around his cabin. He ended up hanging himself. He ended up killing himself. And when they found his body, they found scraps of paper on his person and all around his cabin with this Latin phrase, I think it was in hoc signo vincus, which is in his name you shall conquer, which is the kind of thing. Now, I haven't found that phrase specifically in any powwow books, but it does pop up in some other folk magic books. However, it's the kind of things you would find in powwow, which is a Pennsylvania folk magic tradition. And he was, it has its roots in Germany. This guy was a German immigrant. I'm thinking it was some kind of folk magic or powwow he was doing. It seems very, very likely. The other stories were that after he died, people tried to stay in his cabin, some kind of itinerants and stuff, and they would never stay there long because they said there was just weird sounds and strange things, and they just couldn't stay there. And there were reports of his ghost roaming around Wolf Hill, the area where his cabin was. So given all this information, I said, well, I'm going to try to find this guy's cabin. They said he lived in a cave as well. He went to Wolf Hill. He lived in a cave for a while, and then eventually he built a cabin. So I go over to Wolf Hill with John 1 week, and we're looking around, and we really had just about given up. We looked all over the area, and we found some possible candidates, but nothing that I was sure that was it. And we were just getting ready to leave, and I said to the air, I said, they called him Herr Thomas, you know, Mr. Thomas in German. I said to the air, Herr Thomas, if you've got anything to show us, you've got anything to tell us, we're getting ready to go. Now's the time. And on the recording, you can hear wind blow up. You can hear the wind kind of really blow up right after I say that. And then I look over to my right and I said, John, look at that indentation in the ground over there. Doesn't that look kind of foundation-like? And he said, yeah, let's go look at it. And we walked over. And it was a foundation, 100%. It was a foundation right there. Still wasn't 100% sure it was his. In the article, it said he had dug a well. He hand dug a well. And as we're looking at this foundation, I literally said to John, now, if only there was a well, then we would know this was the right place. And I looked to my left and I said, oh my goodness. And took about 10 steps over in between these two boulders is this hand dug well. And we knew we had the right place then. We came back a week later. The cabin, by the way, eventually burnt down after he lived there. And some other people had lived there. It had burnt down about, I think, 2 years after his death. So I returned a week later with Chad. And Chad was very insistent that if it burnt down, there would be charcoal there. I said, oh, okay, you know, let's look. I wasn't entirely, you know, going to discount it if we didn't find charcoal in the ground. But he pushed some leaves aside, and as soon as he did, he's like, yeah, there's charcoal here. This place burnt down. There was a big fire here. And then Chad says, did you find the cave? And I said, no, I didn't think to look for the cave. I said, you know, I thought he could have kind of made a lean-to out of boulders or something, and they were calling that a cave. And he's like, well, let's look up here. And we kind of headed up about 100 yards further up the hill from the cabin. And it's the only place on the hill that John and I didn't check. And as we're walking up there, we see this kind of group of boulders. First, we saw a coffee can, an old, old coffee can that, or coffee pot rather, that may or may not have been his. It was just kind of hanging on a tree. And then we walk past that, and then we see these boulders, and we go to check it and look there. I don't know if it was me or Chad who first saw the cave, because Chad's like, oh, this would be a nice place in these in these boulders, protect you from the wind. Then we look to the side, and sure enough, there's a cave. Like, oh my goodness, there's a cave here. I wonder if this is it. And we got down and started looking, and he had hand-packed rocks to, there were some kind of gaps in the walls of the cave. He had hand-packed rocks to block the wind. I found a chimney on the backside of it. He had built a little chimney. It was 100% someone was staying in this cave, and it was him. So we found not only his cabin, we found his cave, and we've yet to find his grave, but I know the cemetery in which he's buried. So this is really only a matter of time. So that one was really special, because I'm very interested in Powell, very interested in Gettysburg, and to actually be able to track down and find this hermit's house, you know, where he was, and the cave in which he stayed was really exciting and really fun for me.
That whole episode was such a, like, very cinematic. I mean, you really could have made a documentary about that entire situation, and it would, you know, it would fit so well. And it just, you really did a really good job of, you know, the investigation and incorporating the more magical and paranormal aspects into it, which I know, because in a lot of the other Hermit episodes, it kind of takes a back seat to the history of it all.
Well, there's not a lot of it in some of it. You know, some of these are just guys who lived alone, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting to me that, like, whenever, you know, because you said that he was into powwow and his place burned down, and I find it fun, you know, there's this thing about locations that are, you know, either magic was done there or it was imbued with some sort of magical aura, and something always happens to it. I mean, his shack, you look at Aleister Crowley and Boleskine House, that burned down. That's always been kind of an interesting paradigm that I feel has always been neglected.
I didn't even think about that. That's an awesome angle to explore. When I make the documentary, we'll have to include that.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't remember the name of the episode, but The Hermit, I think it's probably one of the first ones I listened to and one of my favorites. He was I think he was a musician, or he kept animals. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Need more information. This could be a couple of different ones.
I'm pretty sure it was in Pennsylvania, and he was like a musician, and he was known for having a lot of animals around him. That's the most notable part for me, at least.
Oh my goodness, I'm drawing a blank.
It's okay. It's kind of, I mean, I don't have the name.
I do so many episodes. People often ask me, like, hey, what episode number was this? And I'm like, I don't know, because I do, you know, episode a week, and they tend to blend together.
Yeah, that'll happen to me soon. I mean, I'm only up to, this will be episode 15 or 16, something like that. So, but I'm sure that'll happen to me too.
I'm trying to flip through the list of episodes real quick, but I don't think it's gonna pop out at me.
That's okay. It's interesting because there's this archetype, and I think I've brought it up on a couple episodes, about my dream has always been to wander into the woods and find a shack with a wizard in it and learn all of his magical skills and techniques. And that, you know, that archetype seems to carry over into the new world as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very powerful thing. You know, if you want to talk about hermits and magicians, you know, probably the most famous one is Merlin, who himself was a hermit wild man. He was both of those things. Supposedly, the story goes, it was a very big battle, and it was very brutal, and he felt somewhat responsible, if not for causing the battle, for not stopping it. And he looked around at all the death and destruction, and just went to the woods. And very interestingly, they call this Merlin's wild man phase, where he became a wild man, and they refer to him as a wild man in this phase. And this is when he learned how to talk to the animals, it is said, and so forth. So here you have, you know, maybe the most famous folklore magician of all time, had both a hermit and a wild man phase. So, you know, you can go back to that. It's certainly entwined with the occult tradition for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, just going on that theme, would you consider Nelson Raymeyer to be a hermit?
He was referred to by some as a hermit. Yeah, I think so. I mean, the catch there is he was a lot more involved in his community than people commonly know. Let's say that. I think a lot of that information was buried. He was he ran for school board. He was practicing healing. He was a powwow doctor and was healing people. I don't believe he charged a cent, by the way. I think he would, if you came to him and you had a problem, he would try for you. He'd try to powwow and try to heal you. And he was, and this I think is a big issue with this. He was a socialist. He was known to have socialist posters in his house. And I personally think that that is as big an offense in these parts as, you know, occultism. And when people lecture on Raymeyer here, not all of them, but often the tone of the lecture is, yeah, he got murdered, but, you know, he was doing that bad stuff down there. He was doing that, messing with the occult stuff down there. So, you know, and the tone is usually like, oh, that poor Blymeyer and those poor, you know, Hess boys that helped him basically murder Raymeyer. It's very disturbing where I'm like, well, no, poor Raymeyer, he's the victim here. Like, and no matter what he was doing. But I do think the fact that he was a socialist kind of plays into the fact that they make him into this kind of devil. I think that, you know, it was a double-edged sword. I call it on one hand and socialist on the other. Let's turn this guy into a demon.
Yeah, I didn't even know that. I don't know if they included that in the documentary of Hex Hollow, which is a very good documentary. If anyone hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it.
They did not include that at all. it's hard to find. It's mentioned in the book Hex in passing. And when there's a little bit about how strange he was, and they talk to his wife, and they said, you know, why they lived in separate residences. And she's like, yeah, I didn't live with him. He's too damn peculiar. That was a quote. I always love that, too damn peculiar. And they mentioned in this little section where they're talking about, you know, how strange he was, that he had these socialist posters up in his house. And very recently, there's certain stories in York that they really don't like people talking about. And the newspaper articles about the Raymeyer, about the Hex murder, were not available in newspaper archives until very recently. Very recently, they finally became available. For years and years, 1928 just wasn't there. Like, it was like, huh. And they had it every year before and every year after. But 1928 just wasn't there. But recently, they've become available. And I have found one article that goes into more detail about him being a socialist that I, at some point, I may rewrite the Raymeyer story. And I can talk about that aspect of it as well, because it seemed to be buried by most people, including on that documentary. Like you said, it's a good documentary. But yeah, there's no mention of that at all.
Yeah. And I know that, and we're going to keep on the hermit theme, I promise, but you know me, I'm going to have to divert to this. You've had some interesting experiences in Hex Hollow, which is right behind, it's near Raymeyer's house, correct?
Yeah, that whole valley used to be called Raymeyer Valley, a name for that family. And it is a very, very interesting place. And yeah, I've had some pretty intense stuff happened there for sure.
I know that you've probably told this on 1,000 podcasts, but you mind telling us some of the interesting stuff you've had happen there?
Yeah. I mean, I'll try to keep it brief because it's, you know, like I always say, it's a spider web. It's not a straight line.
I know.
It's very tangled. Not a neat web either. It's very, very tangled and strands go here and there. But it started, I want to say probably 2016, when I walked down a trail. Now, I'd been hiking there since the early 90s and thought I knew every trail in the place. And one day I was there with a friend and I saw a new trail. I was like, I have to take this trail. I don't know. How could I have missed this trail? I've never seen this trail before. And went on this trail and there was another trail that kind of cut off from it. And at the trailhead to that side trail were these big boulders, kind of just naturally were there. And on top of these boulders were smashed a bunch of white quartzite. And it looked like someone had been sitting there for, I don't know how long, just hours and hours and hours, and just smashing white quartzite on the rock, just splinters of white quartzite everywhere. And I said, boy, this is interesting. And then there were three pieces that were kind of laid in a triangle, like it's at the points of a triangle. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I don't know, like, who would sit here and smash quartzite up. I'm going to put a cairn here, so a stack of stones. So I built a stack of stones and left, didn't think anything else of it. And I came back a couple of days later, because it was a new trail, I remember, and I didn't hike the whole trail. I was like, oh, I got to go back and hike the rest of that trail and kind of see where it connects to the other trails. So a few days later, I come back and I go to that trailhead and the rock arrangement had been changed. It had been moved back to that triangle formation. I went, oh, okay, look, somebody's playing a game. So I changed it again. Yeah, built another cairn. Came back maybe a week later, I don't know. At this point, you know, I was going frequently because it's the closest place to my house to get a hike in. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going as frequently as I would later on. And then I saw it change again. So I, you know, I built another cairn and I kept getting more intricate. And every time I'd come back, they would be stacked in that same sort of triangle formation again. Sometimes the three at the points of the triangle and sometimes three with like one in the middle. Like, so, you know, one at each point and then one in the middle of the three points of the triangle. Every time. And I'm thinking, this is like, if somebody's playing a game, then if I was doing it, I would match the complexity of what other people were leaving there, for instance. So I'm thinking, like, is this a person? And if so, what is the, like, what's the point of this? And I mean, I am thinking it's a person at this point, but, you know, knowing Bigfoot as I do know that stone stacking and cairns and stuff are part of the whole Bigfoot mystery. Something's like kind of raising my antenna a little bit, but, you know, whatever. I'm mentioning this to my wife and she's like, oh, you're just playing chess with somebody. She's, you know, playfully calling it playing chess. And then she started calling it my chessboard, which it became a sort of nickname for that area. So I was coming back I became kind of obsessed with it, where I was coming back sometimes two and three times a week. And every time I change them, they'd be changed. Every time I change them, they'd be changed. And I'm like, wow, it's gotta be somebody who's visiting the park as much as I am. This is pretty incredible. So I went there with my wife and kids one time to take a hike and they wanted to hike. There's a pond kind of in the lower part of the park. And I wanted to go up to where the chessboard was. I said, hey, you guys hike around the pond. I'm going to run up, you know, change the stones around and I'll come back. And at this point, I was photographing them every time so I could tell how they changed and so forth. So I go up and I stack them up and I take a photograph. And then I go back down and I meet my wife and kids. And she says, oh, I want to go up and see your chessboard. I was like, oh, okay. So we turn around and go back up there. And this is, you know, maybe 15 minutes have passed, maybe 20 at the absolute most. And I get back up there and I'm showing her, you know, the different stone stacks and stuff and telling her, like, yeah, this is where this happened and this is where this happened. And under one of the stacks of stones I had made was a big leaf. And it stunned me to the point where I literally started looking around like for the person who was there, because I did not put a leaf under that and leaves don't fall under stacks of stones. So it was just a big leaf. So the stones were stacked on top of a leaf. And I'm looking around like, where is it? Someone has to be here. Like if there's a person, they have to be looking at us right now. they had to, you know, they have to be here. And I, you know, I couldn't find anybody, of course, but now I got really interested after that happened. So this is like, this is amazing. Like something weird's going on. So I started visiting more and more. Eventually, that kind of went all through summer and fall. There was a day in January. There was a little bit of snow on the ground. And I was, as far as I know, the only one in the park. There's a couple parking areas. You know, I didn't go inspect every parking area, but it was a cold day. It was a weekday. And I believe I was in the only one in the park. And I'm hiking. I'm going up to where this, you know, the chessboard is. I'm headed up the hill and I hear this, what sounds like a stone clack, like two stones being clacked together real hard behind me, to the point where I walk back down the hill and kind of look over this ridge where it sounded like it came from to see if I could see anyone or anything down there. Didn't see anything. Back up the hill I go. I'm about halfway up the hill and I hear these crows. Now there was a murder of crows, a group of crows that were there, and they had become used to me. They would announce my presence every time I was there. You could hear them call, like telling the other crows, "Hey, this guy's here." But they wouldn't go crazy. They would just, you know, they'd hang out in the trees and just, you know, they'd call a bit and say, like, you know, humans here or whatever they were saying in crow language. But this day, they went nuts, and they went like, I mean, absolutely bat scat. I hear them just screaming and calling and going nuts. And then they flew over my head and they flew so close to me that if I would have just had to raise my walking stick, I could have hit a crow out of the air. And there were so many of them. It was just this whole group of crows. In fact, I thought, like, please don't poop on me, because there were just so many of them. And they went overhead. And at the time I went, you know, kind of, huh, that was weird. And I keep going up the hill. And I get to the chessboard and I start trying to rearrange the stones. I don't know if I had actually gotten to the point where I was rearranging them or not. And I'm hit with this smell, just this wicked bad smell, rotting flesh, garbage, everything you hear in every Bigfoot report, like that kind of, like, you know, almost make you retch kind of smell. Now, this is in January. If you smell that in summer, you can usually go, well, there's a dead animal rotting nearby. And that smell just kind of hangs in the air. But in winter, you usually don't get that kind of hit in the face with death kind of smell. And I was like, whoa. Along with the smell came this intense fear. I've hiked there 1,000 times alone before and hundreds of times alone since, probably. I'm not afraid of hiking alone. This is not a bit of wilderness. This is a county park. It's a beautiful park. There's plenty of woods and trees and stuff there, but it's not like I'm 10 miles out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm hit with this fear, and I'm literally like, I wanted to run, but I couldn't run. I was so scared. I think my knees locked up. And so I'm literally just leaning on my walking stick, trying not to fall and trying to be brave. And I'm telling myself, you know, I've read a million Bigfoot encounters. I know this is all hallmarks of Bigfoot stuff. And by the way, I'm not saying 100% this is Bigfoot. I'm just saying these are elements of Bigfoot encounters. So I'm leaning on my walking stick and I'm saying, like, you know, well, this is what you wanted, like, you know, kind of man up, trying to steel myself. Like, I guess I'm going to see something because I can't run. I'm not moving. So I hear a wood knock from the opposite direction from the stone clack. And then I'm really kind of worked up at that point. And then I heard this sound, and it sounded like metal gears, but not great big machinery. It sounded like little metal gears. Just click, 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 three kind of metal clicks. And with that sound, the smell went away, the fear went away, everything just dissolved. And I was able to, like, stack the stones. I was able to look around the area. I was cautious, you know, because I had been so afraid, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't taken hold by that fear where I, you know, that fight or flight thing where I just wanted to run. So I kind of look around a little bit and you know, like, wow, that was amazing. That was weird. And I start back down the hill and coming off of a deer trail, I don't know if these were there and I didn't see them because it would have been about the place where the crows flew over my head. So I don't know if I was looking up at crows and I didn't see these, or if I just did notice them, I walked over top of them and they were there before, or if they were new, I do not know. But in that light coating of snow coming off this deer trail were footprints. And I call them maybe footprints because they weren't really defined. It was a very thin coating of snow. I couldn't see individual toes, but they sure looked like the shape of big, like 16 inch long, 8 inch wide bear footprints, B-A-R-E, not B-E-A-R, B-A-R-E, what would confirm to a Bigfoot footprint. And they came off that deer trail. They came across the main trail and up into a cornfield where I lost them. They either stopped or they just, the ground was so broken up that I couldn't follow them anymore. I went, wow. I took some pictures and I thought, like, there's, you know, no one's going to believe that these are Bigfoot footprints, but I'll take a couple pictures anyway. You know, maybe even, you know, believers probably wouldn't be convinced by it, but given the rest of the situation, I was like, wow, that was pretty intense. So I leave. I'm very, very fascinated in this. This continues, the stone stacking and things changing continues into, I think, the spring of that year. And the quartz was very sharp. And I was stacking the quartz and I cut myself on the quartz. And I bled all over them and bled all over my walking stick. But I bled all over the quartz. And I'm thinking, ooh, this should kick things up. This is going to really, like, take it to another level because now we've added blood to the mix. And that was the end of the stone stacking at that location. No more. It was never changed again. It ended right there. So with the blood, whatever that did, that ended the chessboard. Now, other things are happening in my life. I had started reading Mike Clellan's book on owls, The Messengers, which is a fantastic book. It has to do with owls and the supernatural in general, but more specifically the alien abduction experience, quote unquote alien abduction, and how many contactees have these owl experiences. I had become fascinated with owls, but I thought, well, like, Mike's already written this book. I'm not going to be like the owl guy. Mike is the owl guy. However, I will, you know, if I run into a cool looking owl statue, I'd like to have like one owl statue. I love statues. So I was like, I'd like to have like one owl statue. At the same time, I'm writing these historical Bigfoot books. I'm illustrating Bigfoot. Bigfoot is like my entire life. And I thought, oh, I want to illustrate something that's not Bigfoot. I want to illustrate, just give me something cool to illustrate, something else I can work on. So I'm not just only drawing Bigfoot all the time. And I found this book, The Life of Merlin, this old text. And I thought, oh, Merlin, that'll be fun to illustrate. So I'm at an antique store and I'm with my wife and there's this whole shelf of owl statues in the antique stores for a dollar each. I'm like, what? It must have been somebody's collection. Somebody must have, you know, I'm thinking it was like somebody's aunt who they disliked or something left them this collection of owls. And they're just like, I don't care. I'm selling them all for a dollar each, you know? So I'm looking at this massive collection of owls. And most of them were very realistic kind of ceramic owls. And, you know, I didn't dislike them, but they weren't humming for me. They didn't really appeal to me. But I see this one, it's this wooden owl. It's bigger than the other ones. It's kind of a folk art carving of an owl. And I thought, that's the one. I'm taking that one home with me. So I pick it up and I'm looking at it and I turn it around. And on the backside of this owl is the face of a very typical wizard carved. So here, you know, I thought, like, I'm going to do this wild man book, or this Merlin book rather. And here's this Merlin, what looks to be, you know, very typical representation of a wizard carved on the back of this owl, the one owl I chose. I was like, okay, that's a neat synchronicity. In Mike Clellan's book, The Messengers, there's a woman that said she could see an owl anytime she wanted. All she would do is before she went on a hike, she'd say to the woods out loud, I would like to see an owl today. This sounds very woo, very new agey, but I'm not above trying this stuff. So I go to back to Hex Hollow, and I'm getting ready to hike up to the chessboard, or wherever I was going. I think I was going to the chessboard at this point. There's another area that we'll get to very shortly. But in any case, I said, I would like some antlers today to the woods out loud, because again, I didn't want owls to be my thing. And I like collecting bones and antlers and stuff. I thought it'd be cool to find some antlers. And off I go on my hike, and I'm hiking through the woods, and I see something off to the side of the trail. It's like off the trail, and it's the wind's blowing it. It's white and it's kind of blowing in the wind. And often people will, they'll clean up after their dogs and they'll leave the baggies on the trail, or sometimes they'll change their kids' diapers and they'll leave, you know, tie up the baggies and leave them on the trail. And it's very rude and I dislike it. But at the same time, I try to clean up as I go along when I see that kind of stuff. And I got very upset because I thought someone had tied a plastic bag in the tree, you know, with some trash or whatever in it. Like, oh, what's that? So now I have to, you know, go off trail and see what this is tied in this tree and deal with it. So I walk off trail, and as I get closer to this, it's not a plastic bag at all. It is the entire tail section of a barn owl. Now, barn owls are white. They have very, you know, white feathers, and not just a couple feathers. This is the entire, look like somebody tore the tail off of a barn owl and stuck it onto, this wasn't even a thorny tree, but there was a very kind of sharp, almost like thorny part of this one branch. And someone or something had very forcefully pushed this tail section onto that. And I just thought immediately, I was like, I asked for antlers and I got owls anyway. And it really kind of stunned me. Put the tail feathers in my bag and off I go. And I don't think this was the same day. This might have been the next time I was there hiking. I don't think it was the same day. I think it was the following time. But in any case, I'm walking down the trail and something hits me as I'm walking down the trail. I'm thinking about these books and these illustrations I'm doing. And it hit me that, as I said before, Merlin had this wild man stage. And I almost start laughing out loud because it's like, I can't get away from wild men here. I wanted to illustrate Merlin to get away from this Bigfoot stuff. And actually, you know, Merlin himself was a wild man. And right as this thought hits me, I hear something like big, like pushing through the leaves up ahead of me. And right out in front of me on the trail burst this barred owl. Now, not a barn owl. This is a barred owl, different kind of owl. Out during the day, busts out right in front of me and flies down the trail in the direction I was going. Right as I had that thought, it was like right on cue. I had this thought like, wait, Merlin was a wild man too. Bam, here comes this owl through the leaves. And I was like, whoa, what is going on? I had found this other place. So the stone stacking had kind of died, like I said, after I bled on the quartz. And I randomly went off trail. I just found this kind of interesting ridge. And I went off trail to kind of look over the edge of the ridge. And off this trail where no one goes was in the crotch of this tree, this stack of stones. Now, huge stones, like really, really heavy. Like I can't pick them up. I could not lift them. They were the base stones. It was like two or three of those as the base. And then like a couple smaller ones on the top. So there's this like huge cairn. And in this tree, below these stones, was kind of a hollow in the tree. Well, I started leaving food there and, you know, sort of as offerings, and it would disappear every time. And of course I'm thinking, well, you know, it's raccoons or squirrels or whatever, but you know, it was something to do and it was fun. And one day I decided, well, I'm going to leave alcohol there. And I ordered these like glass bottles with corks in them, these tiny little glass bottles. And we just had some cheap wine or something. And I filled one with wine and put the cork in. And I went down there. And I hadn't been asking for anything before. And this day I asked again, but I dropped the little bottle of wine in the hollow of that tree. And I said, I would like a skull, please, to the woods. And off I go on the hike. on the rest of my hike. And I hike out through this field, and I'm in this field, and I notice this stand of trees, maybe a half acre kind of round stand of trees in the middle of this field. And I look at it and I thought, I have been coming here for over a decade, hiking all over this park, and I've never been in that stand of trees. What's in there? I need to go check that out. So I walk across the field, walk into these trees, and inside these trees are what would answer, if it's in Ireland, it would be called a fairy mound. No, we're not in Ireland, and I'm told I'm not allowed to call it a fairy mound because there aren't fairy mounds in America. But if we was in Ireland,
BS
it would be
on that.
Yeah, yeah. This, by all measures, would have been a fairy fort or a fairy mound. And I'm just like, wow, this is so cool. Like, this is such a neat thing in here. And I'm walking up it. And as I'm kind of walking to the top of this huge mound of stone, I start seeing little bits of fur. I'm looking down, I'm like, what is that? Like, what's that little bits of fur? And then I come upon this freshly killed groundhog, just the head. It was just the head of a groundhog, and it had the jaw torn off. And I realized right then, I was like, I asked for a skull, and I got a skull. I mean, 10 minutes later, I got a skull. I literally asked for a skull. I got a skull. Problem was, the skull was covered in gore, and I find that rather gross. I've collected skulls all my life, but I don't do the deal with gore. My wife can, but I do not. I just can't deal with it. So,
you know what that would be, that entire thing would be called in the magical world, right?
What's that?
A successful operation.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Right. Well, it freaked me out, and I literally backed out of the stand of trees, like just, you know, keep trying to like keep my eyes everywhere. My head's on a swivel. I am like, what is this? What, you know, what killed a groundhog? The body wasn't there. Where's the body? It's a fresh, like I said, fresh kill, that just the head ripped off and just laying there. And I'm backing out of this stand of trees, like, what is going on? And I kind of make my way in, you know, the sort of the direction I had been headed in before I went in there. And I'm dazed as it is. And I get to the trail, and I realize I'm standing right where my chessboard was. And that stand of trees would have been where I heard the wood knock come from that day, you know, back in January, years previous to this, or I'm not sure if how much time had passed, a year, maybe a year and a half or something. And I'm just stunned at this point. I'm like, what is going on? This is too weird. I leave. And I came back, I think, one more time and looked for that bottle of wine. Two more times I came back. So I came back once more, looked for it. It was gone. It was not there. And it's in the hollow of this tree. It's off trail. It's not like anybody would know it was there. I couldn't fit my hand in this little hollow. A child could have, but I could not. So the bottle of wine is gone. And I went, wow, that's crazy. And then I came back another time, and it was back again. So tell me what that means. It was there. I could see it right down in the hole, like right where I had left it before. And then every time since I've been, by the way, it's been gone. But very, very strange. And then I had this incredible, like, horrible incident happened about the third time after that I went back. I went with my son to hike, and the night before, I'd been talking with Clint from OK Talk on his podcast, and we were talking about several things. We were just kind of rambling, had different topics of conversation, but one of the things we talked about was Small Town Monsters, which is produced or directed or whatever, like the guy who makes it, his name's Seth Breedlove. We're talking about that. We were talking about the idea that the other is like the Eye of Sauron, to use a Lord of the Ring reference. And if you put on the One Ring, the big Eye of Sauron turns and looks at you. So as soon as you start messing with this stuff, it's like it takes notice of you. And we had talked about, oddly, raccoons. Clint had told me this like raccoon folklore about like how to catch raccoons. They put something shiny in a jug and in the morning, the raccoon will reach in to grab the shiny thing. And in the morning you'll find him like holding onto the shiny thing because, you know, you can't pull it out of the jug. I don't know if that works or not, but that was the folklore that we were talking about. So I drive there and with my son to hike, and we park at the parking lot, and it's literally called Crossroads Parking Lot. It's at a crossroads. Then we go for a hike and we hike around a bit, and I gave him the choice. I was like, you want to go back on the main trail or you want to take this side trail and go back? But like, he doesn't like main trails at all. He'll always choose like the side trail. He's like, so he chose the side trail, of course. And he's in better shape than me and usually hikes about 20, 30 yards ahead of me. And I'm usually trying to catch up to him. And I see him stop up ahead of me and straighten up. And I could tell he's looking at something. And I catch up to him. I said, what are you looking at? He's like, is that a raccoon down there? This is daylight. This is, you know, middle of the afternoon. I say, yeah, that's a raccoon. And he takes a step towards us. I was like, no. That shouldn't be out during the day. We're going to take another trail. So let's go back and we'll take another trail. And I took a step back and I turned around and I could see this thing just hauling at us, like just as fast as it could. It's snarling and hissing as it's coming.
Your certified Gandalf moment is coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I told my son, I said, run, just go. And I had to put myself between this thing and my son, and I'm just stealing myself, like, this is gonna suck, this thing's gonna tear me up. You don't want to fight with a raccoon. And I had my walking stick, which, by the way, is covered with protection enchantments, so, you know, you could tell me if this worked or not. I know where my feelings on the issue, but it's covered with protection charms. And I just thought, I got one shot to get this thing before it gets me. Let's hope I get it. And I brought my stick down on that thing. And my son said, he's never heard my battle cry before. He's like, I just heard your battle cry and then this meaty thud. I said, I had to take care of this thing. Like, it was, and luckily it didn't get me. I broke its neck with the first blow. And or broke its back, I'm not sure which, but I did have cuts all over my legs. At the time I was hiking in shorts. I don't do that anymore. I've had several ticks since, and so now I don't hike in shorts anymore. At the time I used to hike in shorts.
I think I've told you this when we've been out in the woods. I am not afraid of much, but I really, really fear ticks. I cannot, like, it's just, I can't do it. It just scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, I'm going to have to treat my clothing, I think, with permethrin or whatever they call it, because I've had two embedded on me in the last 2 years. It's just, they're just horrible now. So I'm not taking any chances anymore. So I'm going to treat my socks and the socks I used to hike in and my pants with permethrin, and just, that's supposed to deal with it. That's supposed to work. So probably my shoes too. In any case, had cuts all over my legs, was wearing shorts. And because of that, I had to get rabies shots. But in any case, I catch up to my son, and I'm trying to make, you know, light of the situation a little bit, because he's, you know, he's pretty young at the time and his eyes are like, you know, wide as saucers. And he's, you know, pretty scared. And I said something like, hey, you know, the only thing I regret is not saying you shall not pass before I, you know, brought my staff down on this thing. He's, you know, he loves the Lord of the Rings movies. I thought that might lighten the mood a little bit, not thinking at all that I talked before about Lord of the Rings with Clint the night before. So here we have Raccoon, here we have Lord of the Rings. And then I get back to the parking area, the Crossroads parking lot. And I thought, well, animal attack, I guess I better call a park ranger. So I called the park ranger and I said, you know, we had a raccoon attack down here. I don't know what you want to do about it. And they're like, well, wait there. We'll show up. And the park ranger shows up and his name tag said Breedlove. And if you look on the York County Parks website, there is a ranger Breedlove. I'm not making this up. And The minute I saw that name tag, my heart just completely sunk because I knew like this, it was already weird enough, but that's when everything hit me. That's when I was like, everything that we talked about, Clint and I talked about the night before, hit me. All of this like heaviness hit me. And I was just like, whoa, this is it. The only thing I can say is it felt like so much more than just a random thing. It felt very, very real and very, very intentional on the part of, you know, whatever was doing this, whatever was there. Sometime later, I'm doing research for Where the Footprints End, two books I wrote with Josh Cutchin. And
which I have to say before we go on that those two books are one of the catalysts for this show existing.
I'm very proud of those books. Thank you. I'll take that as a high compliment. I'm very, very proud of them. But I was researching sort of the Germanic folklore as regards to earth spirits, earth whites, as they would call them. And there's a set of rules. And one of the rules among them in dealing with these things is to not ask for anything. So you're not supposed to just ask for stuff. So I asked for something. So, but if you do ask for something and they give it to you, you better take it. Like, it's a huge offense if you don't take it. So I'm reading this and I'm like, I broke the rule. I asked for something and I didn't take it. I wanted no part of that gory groundhog head. And I have to feel that it's related. I mean, I got the impression at the time it was related. I still feel like it's related. It messed me up for a time. I did not go to Hex Hollow for a long time. I'll go back there now, but I'm very respectful of that place. I think there is something in that land that is very real. I mean, there's something in all land that's very real. Let me put it that way. I think there are spirits of the earth and we can interact with them. But that one down there is very real and very reactive, and it can hold a grudge, apparently. So I'm very, very respectful and very careful when I hike in Hex Hollow now.
All right, so we're going to get into a lot of stuff before we end, but I just need to put this out there because that just sent chills down my spine, because I've heard you tell this story at least 5 times on your show and on different podcasts. The part that I didn't remember was the name of the park, Crossroads Park.
Now, it was the parking lot.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But still, the reason why that's significant to me, and I haven't talked about this on the show because it's been somewhat of a recent development in my life, is the past... Let's see, we did the first recording for this show in September, and one of the first guests I was going to have was an author who did a book on Hecate, and I didn't really have any interest in Hecate, but this author I knew pretty well, and I knew that she would be part of the ethos of the show and mesh well, but we never had her on. But then, since then, the name Hecate, you know, the deity Hecate has been appearing in my life over and over and over again. And it came to a head about last week because I had a dream. And I have a contested feeling about dreams because I definitely feel that they have the power to influence us and that they are somewhat of a communication for certain sects of the other. But some of them are just our subconscious. But this one dream, I was staying in a boarding house, and Luke, who is a friend of mine, he's been on my show, and he's been on your show subsequently with me. And in the dream, he's teaching me magic, specifically Egyptian magic. And the woman who owns the boarding house is a devotee of Hecate. And so I'm talking to Luke, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on with all this Hecate stuff. And he's like, well, maybe, you know, she's reaching out to you or something, and you might want to, like, reach back and see what she wants. And so I start planning this kind of impromptu write to her, and I think it was Friday, I bought a Hecate statue. That night, Soraya puts out a round table talking about Hecate, and then some other stuff happened on Saturday, And then tonight, which we weren't planning on talking about anything related to Hakate, you talk about Crossroads. And I'm like kind of freaking out over here. So yeah, synchronicity is a very, very real and potent thing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, it's very powerful. And I mean, for me, sometimes it's hard to see anything more, coincidence at all. Since everything seems like a synchronicity, but there are definitely times where you get these synchro storms that happen. It's like, whoa, pay attention when they happen.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think at this point, like, coincidence just doesn't even exist for me at this point. But so kind of tying that into the hermit aura, you mentioned a hermit that had some wild man, that had some Bigfoot or wild man connections.
Yeah. That was William Woodruff.
Okay. Yeah. Did you ever hear, and I think it's Sasquatch Chronicles, but it may have been The Confessional. This is one of those two shows. A guy was on there talking about an area that he would hike a lot, and he knew of a guy who was kind of a hermit type, and he lived in an old wooden shack, and this guy told him that, I think he saw it with the guy, but that there was a white Bigfoot that would come and, like, help him or spend time with him and then just kind of wander off, and he would keep the other Bigfoots at bay because I guess they didn't like him being there. Did you ever hear that story?
I didn't, but I mean, it's you know, totally seems within the realms of this stuff. The William Woodruff story, not only was there Bigfoot seen in the area, he was mistaken for the wild man one time. I'm almost certain it was him. The stagecoach coming between Colebrook River and the other town up there. Again, I'm drawing blanks on it. But Winstead was the stagecoach went between Colebrook River and Winstead. The stagecoach driver said, "Oh, I think I saw the wild man," but then he described him, and he obviously described a human. He said he was wearing boots and overalls, and you know, he was clenching something in his hand, which I half wonder if he wasn't holding the daguerreotype that he was supposed to carry around with him of his lost love. But he was mistaken for, you know, a wild man one time. But there's another story. Strangely enough, he had a telescope. This is early 1900s. And he was a stargazer. And he would go out at night and look at the stars. And one night, he said, a very large black bear was around and chased him into his cabin. And he said he spent the entire night with his back up against the door, and this black bear was outside his cabin. I half wondered, it's like, was that a black bear? Because that seems like, that's pretty crazy behavior for a black bear, not only to attack a human or you know, approach a human in that way, but then to just linger that long outside the cabin. You know, he can hear him outside the door. That sounds very Bigfooty. I'm not saying that's what it was, but you know, part of me, you know, my Bigfoot radar goes up when I read that story. But I thought it was interesting. He was literally stargazing when that happened. So there's that tie-in as well. The hermits. One thing in my introduction to the hermit book, that it will be a while before it's out, but I am working on it. I like to point out that I have a brother who looks at life differently than I do. Let's just say it that way. And he likes to throw around the term loser. And he would call, you know, anybody that looked different or was into things that weren't, you know, accepted by the mainstream, were poor people. They were all losers to him.
So then we're big losers to him.
Yeah. And I always hate that word. And I never let my kids say that about people. I to me, that's horrible to dismiss people. And so it's a very dismissive word. You're a loser. I really dislike that. But in any case, as I'm writing this, I'm thinking like, oh yeah, he would hate this. He would think all these hermits are losers because, you know, they look rough. You know, they're not wealthy. Most of them, occasionally you'll find a wealthy hermit. But most of them are very poor and probably would be homeless, but for their cabins and, you know, live a very meager existence. And I thought the thing about it though, is here, you know, over a century later, I'm finding them. They're not losers. They're found. The people who were just common everyday people who did nothing and looked like everyone else and had no interesting things, but just went along, they're lost. Their stories are lost. So I really like that that angle that I've put on this, that, you know, that they are, how could they be losers when they're found? It's the very, very common people that did nothing extraordinary and live very normal lives. Their lives are lost. We know nothing about them.
That's a very beautiful sentiment, and I absolutely agree with that. The one thing that I wanted to bring up is in the Raymeyer case, there's a, well, I know that she's called a witch. I would probably classify her more as a cunning woman. But have you found in your research with hermits any kind of connection or other, like, witches, so to speak, in your research with hermits?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's so my mother-in-law has become contagiously interested in hermits and has done a bunch of research for me. And she's found a couple, actually, like that I really haven't done that much research on. She's like, you know, saved all the research for me. And she actually just gave me a thumb drive full of research tonight. So I will dig in more. But yeah, there are definitely some, there's definitely some crossover there.
Yeah, I would love to see you do some research on that and kind of see what the parallels are. So that, you know, that's our hermit talk, but we have some more time. And I'm, you know, when we talk about Bigfoot, there's the flesh and blood camp, and then there's the woo camp, which I think you and I are firmly in. Mm-hmm. But when I was, and I think, and you've said this before, and I do steal a lot of your talking points because they're so amazing, but the if you start off in Bigfoot or the paranormal in the woo camp, after a time it becomes not as extraordinary. And so the way to really start out is kind of in that flesh and blood camp, and then once you've exhausted all those options and those hypotheses, woo is the only option.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, woo used to be a really bad word in the Bigfoot community. Like,
oh,
it was,
I know,
very, like, woo, you know, it was
what did flute players, what, right? Did Wes call them flute players? Yeah,
flute players. Yeah,
yeah. When I was a flesh and blood type, and this was when I was much younger, because I've been into Bigfoot since I was a kid. But you know, when I was younger, people would ask me like, "Oh, well, why haven't we found one yet?" or you know, anything like that. And the way that I would explain it is, I would say something along the lines of, and this is kind of goes into my interest in transcendentalism and Emerson and things like that. When, if you take a being that is obviously highly intelligent and very evolved, it's very likely that instead of going in, you know, building cities and keeping out the wild, they just embraced the wild and they, you know, sort of retained skills and techniques that are completely natural but seem unnatural to us because we've lost them, because we've drowned them out with modernity. And so I kind of feel that the hermit phenomena kind of goes into that a little bit. I mean, I don't know if you would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's this, you know, wild man is a spectrum, right?
Right.
So you have your wildest of wild men, your Bigfoot, and then everything in between, you know, on up to, I even think, you know, when we talk about flannel man, this kind of lumberjack like guy that people see, the spirit or entity or whatever he is, we talk about on Strange Familiars a lot. I even wonder if he's like half a wild man, if he's like the bridge between us and the wilder wild man, you know? So I think of wild man as a spectrum, and I think, you know, hermits are on that wild man spectrum, certainly.
I definitely agree with that. Now, you've made Pennsylvania, specifically York, Pennsylvania, your gold mine of content and stories and folklore and all the things that you investigate. And I'm curious to know, of all the places that you've investigated and gone to in search of the paranormal and the weird stuff, besides Ray Meyer's Hollow, or Hex Hollow, have you noticed any kind of magical or occult connections to some of the locations that you've investigated?
I mean, you know, you find graffiti here and there. you never know how seriously to take that. You know, back in the satanic panic days, every time somebody found, you know, 666 or a pentagram spray painted under a bridge, that was, you know, there was a satanic cult in operation there. You know, sometimes I think it's just kids. In fact, I remember one of these very kind of earnest, you know, Satans everywhere, there's satanic groups everywhere kind of documentary, and they're showing their evidence of a satanic cult operating there in this, like, it was an abandoned house or something. And they flashed this, you know, here's the satanic graffiti, and it was the Slayer like logo, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah. Is it evidence of a satanic cult, or were teenagers there? You know what I mean?
It's exactly.
Like, you know, but, so yeah, you find that kind of stuff. You know, it's hard to separate this stuff for me. I have found in Codorus Park, before we started experiencing any kind of woo stuff there, I had found a witch bottle in one of the cemeteries in Codorus Park. So someone was definitely doing rituals there. It's the bridge in Gettysburg. And we, you know, I talk about that in the Witch Cloud book and audio series we did. I talk about sort of having this vision of doing a ritual on the bridge, and then talking to one of the tour guides that leads ghost tours there, and he talks about his friend finding a pentagram on the bridge one night. So, you know, was I getting some kind of vision of that ritual that someone else had been doing? I don't know. In a sort of a, you know, Soraya Ascath time loop fashion, was I getting this information from the future, from the past, filtered through? I don't know, but there does seem to be, you know, some hint of it, at least at the what they call suicide bridge there in Gettysburg. But I haven't found, you know, as much of it as I would think. But again, I'm not that sensitive to it. In other words, I'm the guy who's going to look at the 666 and go, that's just kids. It's not a satanic cult. You know what I mean?
I would definitely feel the same way.
Yeah. So I need, you know, more. But, you know, a lot of these places, you know, there were powwow doctors operating, but that may be everywhere in the United States. You know, at some point, you know, folk magic was a lot more common than it is. So
I know that, like, Appalachian folk magic is a pretty big deal in a lot of circles these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Granny magic and stuff. Yeah. And that's tied in. I mean, some of that, there are pockets of Appalachia where it's strict, you know, straight up powwow. They were using the long lost friend and stuff. So it's all very similar anyway. It's hard to, you know, draw lines between this is granny magic and that is powwow. You know, it's very, very similar. It's all folk magic.
Right. You know, when the area that you and I both love, and we will carry over your terminology and say Gazoo's Woods, the first time I was ever there, now I hadn't heard your episode about it at this time. It was only after I'd been there that I heard it. When we went up there, it was probably, you know, 2 a.m. It was a full moon. I remember that. And we found in very close proximity to where you and I had kind of decided I was going to leave this little offering site.
Mm-hmm.
What looked to be a little bit off the trail, not a Wiccan ritual site, but like a very naturalistic druid site. And it was very, very ornate. All kinds of glyphs, like made out of twine and wood, hung from low hanging trees and things like that. Now, it wasn't there when I went back the next time.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that was always very interesting. And you and I have had our little adventure there.
Oh, and, yeah. And well, there's two oyster shells in the cemetery in that area. And
plus those damn kids putting stuffed animals in the cemetery.
Right, right. But I mean, those oyster shells had coins on them. And there's been coins on those tombstones too before. So somebody's doing, you know, if not ritual, some kind of offering, at least in that cemetery as well. Those were not me.
Yeah, I know. Because, you know, you showed them to me and you said very flat out, you know, that wasn't me. And I believe you. One thing that, and this is an area that I've been starting to explore, I am somewhat in the minority here because I see a distinction between the term magic and the term mysticism. And I feel that they're sort of two sides of the same coin, but they are not the same.
I would agree with that.
And so the way that I've always kind of seen magic, and I know you're going to hate this, but when it comes to things like Solomonic magic and the more traditional stuff, there are rules, and that only works with those rules. When you deviate from the rules, things kind of go, you know, haywire. But when you have mysticism, that is where will and intent and not really having any kind of formal rules or training really plays into it. It's all about you putting as much of your own energy into it. And so I see so many parallels between certain mystical practices and what we would consider Bigfoot offerings and a lot of the paranormal phenomena that we see. And so I've been trying to go down this road of, you know, we'll take Hecate, for example, and the guy that you had on your show, and I'm going to have him on my show sometime soon, W.T. Watson, with his Black Dog book. If you look at Hecate's folklore, one of the things that she is heavily associated with, and many people report seeing after doing a ritual or an offering to Hecate, are large black dogs, usually with glowing red or yellow eyes. And so I'm curious to see if a lot of the entities that people experience just, you know, out in the woods aren't either manifestations or runoff from some kind of devotional work or offering work to the, you know, the old gods, so to speak.
There was there's a guy on YouTube. I don't listen to him anymore. I didn't listen to him that much before because he's very kind of American Protestant in his approach to things, kind of born again type guy. But he had some shows where he was talking about people doing, you know, Wiccan rituals, which to him was, you know, paramount to Satanism, you know.
They always he's making
no, yeah, he's making no distinction there. But and then, you know, Bigfoot activity happening around that. So you know, are these side effects, or are, you know, is Bigfoot attracted to occult activity? You know, one of the theories I like to play with, and, you know, they're all theories. I love to say that, you know, nobody knows what they are. Your guess is as good as mine. And anybody who says they know 100% what they are, they need to provide proof, because right now, you know, it's still a mystery. And I think it's likely to remain a mystery for, you know, as long as we're around. They're going to be around, and it's going to be a mystery probably. We're not going to put one in a cage.
I absolutely agree with that.
But one of the theories I like to play with is, like, you know, kind of like what you were talking about before, you know, where kind of we split off and went one way, and they were very focused on, you know, living in the woods and developing the skills necessary for that. But what if they are a completely magical, shamanic-based culture, whereas we are a technology-based culture? You know, we went down the technology road, and they went down the magic road. You know, it's a very interesting thought.
That's a very, very fascinating road to go down.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what if Bigfoot are, you know, master wizards, you know, and we are, you know, we're over here with our computers in our pockets, you know, texting each other, and they're mastering, you know, the magical arts. I mean, you know, it's an outside chance, but hey, you know, it's certainly fun to think about.
That's what I'm here for, to explore these outside chances.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, how fun would that be, really, right?
Absolutely. I would love to learn some magic from Bigfoot. That's one of my goals.
You know, one of my working theories as regards to tree structures, you know, the flesh and blood folks are all like, well, they're game, to hide behind, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't think of the name either, but if they are that's the worst, you know,
yeah, they're
game
awful.
Trap
they're,
I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, or they're, you know, they put their little ones in that. For what reason? Why? They're not going to stay in there. You know, it's like, they're not houses. They don't keep any weather out. They're not blinds. They're not game blinds. They, you know, they there are weird structures in the woods. And one of my theories has been, what if they're three-dimensional sigils or kind of like altars to Bigfoot gods, you know, or fetishes or some kind of, you know, something to do with like Bigfoot ritual, which I don't think anyone had brought up before. You know, I kind of floated that idea. I love that idea. And I also, lately, I've become wonder if they don't mark other things for them, not trail markers. If they don't seem to need trail markers, people say, oh, they're trail markers and, or they're marking Bigfoot hunting grounds. Why? Like they're going to hunt wherever they want to hunt. they don't need to mark their hunting grounds. I think it's maybe they might be markers of where they have encounters with humans. And it might be as important to them as us encountering them is to us. And they might be marking these places by putting these structures like, hey, this is where we encountered a person. Like let's make this structure here for whatever reason, for mystical reasons or practical reasons. I don't know. But again, just a theory. I still like the three-dimensional sigil, though. I really like that.
Yeah, I do too. But that whole idea, I know that kind of spawned from your friend Chad's dream.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was in that Kador State Park. He had a very intense dream of, not to do with Bigfoot, but of us encountering a grays.
Your favorite. And,
yeah. And we went back to look in the area of his dream, and here's this kind of pretty amazing structure that's right at the location of his dream, and that kind of sparked that idea. And then gazoos as well. Right after that, when I saw that thing that we were walking towards, and then I looked away and looked back, and then it wasn't there. When we walked up to the area where it was, there were what, four or five structures there.
Yeah. And they were, no, that would have been the worst, like camping structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still can't decide what is more fantastical or spooky, you seeing that thing or what I came upon when I went back to what I was going to use as my offering site. That's still kind of, I still don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. Have you talked about that on here?
No, not yet. I was waiting to bring that up for when you and Chad were on with talk about the witch cloud. I've been holding back a bunch of stuff because I want Chad on to get his thoughts.
Yeah, he's a hard man to pin down. What with his day job and all.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. But Tim, I want to thank you so much. This has been one of the best conversations. I got to tell you.
Oh, thanks for having me on. We'll do it again.
Absolutely. Very soon. And you'll have to let me know when the Hermit book comes out so I can promote it.
It'll be a while. My hope is by the end of the summer, but we'll see. There's a lot of work to do.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye. This is part one of my talk with Timothy, and the second half is on our Patreon for patrons. Luke Bell joins us in the conversation as we delve deep into the paranormal and the occult and the strange connections between the two. If you would like to hear the second half of this conversation, you can click the link to our Patreon in the show notes below. It's only $4 a month to sign up, and you get a ton of exclusive content and opportunities to contribute to the show. All of Timothy's links are in the show notes below. For those of you who are patrons or decide to sign up, I will see you over there. And for everyone else, have a good night and stay tuned for more Strange Dominions.